Coming to you live from downtown Detroit, this is Benzinga's Pre-Market Prep with your host, Joel Conan.
This is a volatile puppy here, isn't it?
And Dennis Dick.
I've bitten a penny. I will buy the stock for a penny.
With everything you need to start your trading day.
Good morning, traders and investors. Welcome to this Friday, March 10th edition of Benzinga's Pre-Market Prep. I'm Spencer Israel here with Joel Conan and Dennis Dick. We've got a jam-packed show for you today. We're going to talk about that jobs number coming out at the usual time, and leading into that, we're going to get Brent to give us some analysis and some previews. So we got the jobs number. We also have three guests for you. One at 8:15, that's Paul Mlejenovic. He's the author of Stock Investing for Dummies and The Raven Capitalist. We have an 8:35 guest, that's Michael Carvin. He's the founder and CEO of Smart Asset. And then at 9 o'clock, we have a great, great, great guest, Adam Feuerstein, senior columnist at The Street. If you follow the biotech stocks at all, you know who Adam Feuerstein is. He is maybe the most influential reporter when it comes to biotechs, and he will be joining us at 9 a.m. So a jam-packed show for you folks today. Joel, how's it going with the S&Ps?
We are looking up here. We're trading up 7 points here. Everyone is just looking for a good jobs number. A lot of it based off the ADP data, trading up 7.5 handles, 73.75. We're clearing Tuesday's high here, so let's see if we can climb back into the 22.80 handle. Your five-day high at 83.25, that's 10 points above. Crude trying to get back above $50, up only 36 cents, a bad couple days. Trying to recover here in the crude market. And gold now under 1,200, silver under 17. Pulled the rug out right beneath both of those commodities here, commodities on the skids here. We'll see if I can find a bottom or at least consolidate here around 1,200 in the gold market. Dennis, how are you doing here on this Jobs Friday?
Doing good. Excited for a jobs number here. I mean, first of all, question. Why did we not have the jobs number last week? Do we know that? Do we have an answer for that?
Well, Brent was theorizing that it was because the last day of the month was on a Tuesday, and so there are only 3 days in March. In the first week was only 3 days, so he's
wasn't enough.
So it wasn't enough, right?
Okay. And then second thing is we've obviously already had a really hot ADP number here, so I think the whole market is definitely expecting this to be a hot number as well. What are we looking at, like 225? Is that what the expectations are?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, we're going to bring Brent on. He's going to preview this at 8:25.
Yep.
We'll pop him back in here. But, you know, looking here, so analyzing it, first of all, I like to always look, you know, what's happened recently here. And on the hot ADP number, you really had the banks pop. They popped big time there on that number. But what happened that day? They ended up giving it back, you know. So you can see, you know, Bank of America, we even talked about it yesterday, the key reversals that we had there on a lot of these trades in the banks, because they were popped on the hot number and then they gave it back. So could that happen again? History does tend to repeat itself, especially recent history. So I want to see what this number is. I want to see what the bank's reaction does. I mean, if this number comes in weaker, they are going to probably murder the banks. But if it comes in really, really hot, maybe they continue to lift. But they're already up big time here pre-market. I mean, look, you know, it started over in Europe overnight here. You got Deutsche Bank, you got ING, you got Barclays, all up 2-3% here. Actually, not Barclays, but ING. And Credit Suisse is also trading higher. You got Banco Santander, which is SAN, it's trading higher. And Royal Bank of Scotland's trading flat. So they're not doing as much in the UK, but the European ones are really hot here this morning. So now you look here at our banks, and our banks are very hot in the pre-market as well. JP Morgan trading up almost 1%, Citigroup up almost 1%, Bank of America trading up 1.1% ahead of this jobs number, market expecting this to happen, obviously a hot number here. I think the number's got to be really hot for them to continue. If it's just somewhat hot, they might actually hit the banks. So I'm looking at it here. What do you think risk return on the banks here now, Joel? Check out Bank of America, first of all. We've been up in this 2565 to 2580 area a couple of times, and we've failed each time. Is this the time we're going to break out here? Because we're already up 30 cents in the pre-market.
I mean, there it is, 2580. You missed it by 3 cents the other day, 2577. I mean, and you got to think there's just got to be a mound of sellers at 26, right? I mean, a whole
number.
I would
think so.
A whole number. So, I mean, I'm not, you know, Bank of America, how many times, if you do get a big pop, up 50 cents. I mean, how many times are you going to make money buying Bank of America up, you know, 30, 40, 50 cents on the day? It usually back and fills, but just a consolidation. Look how long the consolidation period was after the election. Took almost a month and a half. It traded in a $2 range, and then it, boom, took off again. So you're just in a part of a consolidation phase here, using your technical levels to guide you. 2580, the high of the move, you know, hit 2577 the other day. Currently trading at 2564, only 200,000 shares have traded.
I just think risk return might be leaning to the short side at this number. And just talking a day trade here, I don't know if I want to go into the number short. What I would like to see happen is a hot number, banks pop even more, and then we get a repeat potentially of the ADP day when, you know, obviously we had a hot number and they pop, and then after about a half an hour to an hour at the open, the 10 o'clock turn, I like to call it, they start to find some sellers and profit takers. So, you know, we'll see. I'd love to get a shot short Bank of America just below 26 bucks because I think you're right, Joel. First time up there, I think there's going to be some size to chew through on the book at 26. Couple other ones, too, to just talk about, though. Let's just preview a few of these banks because these are the ones that are going to move on this jobs data. Citigroup, for instance. Citigroup made a new high on the move on the ADP data, got all the way up to 62.50 before giving most of it back. Little inside day there yesterday. Just quick technicals here on Citi.
I mean, you got that island top, I guess. I don't know if I'm making up a term there, but it's all by itself. It's 62.53, so anybody caught up there gets back up again. 62.09, we're trading above that, the high from yesterday. Coming on the downside, I mean, we're $1.10 above the $61 level, two-day low at 61.06. So 61 even, 62.53. I think those could be some good numbers in Citigroup. And I don't know, Dan. I mean, we'd have to do a little bit of research. But, you know, are these – I mean, obviously the incremental changes in rates are good for banks. But, I mean, I don't know how to quantify it with, you know, the amount of market cap that's, you know, being added in anticipation of this.
Well, and we used to say, you know, interest rate hikes are bad for the overall market, but lately they've been rallying the market on it too, which seems just completely irrational. I mean, right now this morning, I'm just looking here on the screen, and the only thing I see really in the red here is gold. Gold's trading weaker here. You've got oil down just slightly, but basically flat. But I start looking across the board, and I mean, stocks are up across the board here. It's kind of like a little bit of buy everything. I think people may be just nervous ahead of this jobs number to be short anything. But, you know, you've got some defensive stocks that are trading higher here this morning, and that's typically not the case. Usually when you see the market rallying overall, you usually see the TLT selling off significantly. TLT's just kind of hanging out. It is in the red a little bit here this morning, but, you know, even some of the utility stocks were trading slightly in the green here this morning. So difficult, you know, to just come in here and say, oh, everything's going to rally, because you know we see separation. If the risk on day and it ends up, you know, being a hot number, you're going to see some money come out of that other stuff, like your utility stocks and some of your defensive stocks. So, you know, let's see what this number is, 830. Let's see how the reaction is to it. And, you know, if I'm long financials coming into this, though, you want a really hot number. So I'd be nervous being long financials into it. I don't think I want to be short either. I want to see the number. I want to see the reaction, get the information. And then I want to see, you know, if I can get a potential turn maybe around 10 o'clock.
And why didn't we short Detroit Eddy the last couple days? A third of the customers in Michigan are out of power. 600 and
went.
Oh, yeah. And so you look at that. They gapped down and had a couple bad days. There's a lot of people that are hearing like Sunday, Monday, Tuesday before they get their power back. But if you wonder why DTE's been weak the last couple days
The wind was crazy here around the Motor City. Did you get any damage to your house there? I had about four shingles blow off my house. Actually, I went up there and fixed them, but the old roofer bled me. I got back up there. My wife yelled at me for it, but I did climb on the roof myself and fix the roof. Did you get any damage?
No.
You're okay.
Yeah.
My neighbor's fence blew over. I was looking around the neighborhood. Shingles off everywhere, man. It was some crazy wind. They actually said in the D that that the wind was up to 70 miles an hour, and in a severe thunderstorm it usually goes to around 60. So that sustained 70 miles an hour wind is more than you get in a severe thunderstorm. They actually evacuated the Renaissance Center, I heard, because it was swaying too much. That's how windy it was in the D two days ago. Crazy.
Right, and I'm sure you heard about the Michigan basketball plane getting blown off the runway. emergency evacuation. They ended up having to fly out yesterday morning. They got there 35 minutes before their game started, but still pulled out a victory. But little sidetrack there, Dennis, 8-10. We did have some big movers after hours, and I know a shop that you go to a lot, Ulta.
Yeah, you know I love my beauty salons here. ULTA, the beauty shop, they're getting the beats. And, I mean, we've talked about this stock being one of the hottest stocks in the last 5 years. The stock, we even mentioned, I think, yesterday, has went from like $30 or $22 up to $270. And, I mean, it's just a matter of there's so many people sitting on profits on this thing now, and it was going to have to blow it away to go higher here. I don't think the numbers were that bad, but they just weren't good enough because there's so many people sitting on gains in this. Spencer, how did ULTA report?
First, some context, Ulta is up 6,345% since the Hanes bottom, right? Yesterday was actually the 8-year anniversary of the Hanes bottom.
6,000% gainer. So you're telling me if I'm jumping on this train long, I'm a little bit late to the party.
Maybe about 7.5 years late, I would say. Yeah. So anyway, Q4 EPS, $2.24 versus $2.13 as the estimate. So they beat the estimate there. Sales, 1.58 bill versus 1.54 bill. They beat that estimate. Two comps up 16.6%. Those are all good numbers, like you said, Dennis. As far as Q1 guidance goes, that came in a little, pretty much in line, a little lower than the estimate, or at least on the low end, and sales came in lower as well. They expect their fiscal year comps to grow between 8% and 10%. So, like you said, it was the earnings was good, the guidance wasn't great, and you know that's what happens when you got to stop at rallies. It needs to be great to keep rallying.
When expectations are this high for a company, they've got to blow it away. And I mean, maybe they did in the current quarter, but the guidance did not. And that's why they're hitting the stock here this morning. It's down 11 points. Now, am I coming in here shorting this thing in the hole, like we call it, down 4%? Probably not, because, you know, we know the buy the dippers lurk, it seems like, in everything here. So I've, you know, just not made a lot of money shorting a stock down 4% in this market in the last 5 years.
5901, 25901 at your pre-market low. It's been protected here a few times when you've come back to the 260 area. So I bet you some bruised and battered shorts are focusing on that 260 area. When I look at the daily charts as well, I see a couple lows just under 260, at 259, 250, 259.70. So if I had a short looking to cover, like to see if it comes back into that area below that, you could easily trade into the lower 250s.
Also had Verifone report last night, PAY. It's trading down about 1%. This one got the pop, and the fade traders were in, and it's now in the red here. Spencer, PAY numbers.
This is not up 6,000% since the Hanes bottom. Q1 adjusted EPS, 21 cents. That beat by a penny. Sales of 457 million versus 450 million. So they beat by 7 mil on the sales numbers for Q1. As far as Q2 goes, that sales guidance came in line with the estimate. EPS coming in a little lower than the estimate. And they're also getting a downgrade this morning from BTIG. And they removed BTIG did their $21 price target.
What's their new price target? Did they give one?
I don't think they gave one.
Just pull the 21. Yeah. All right, so you got a couple lows here. 1982, 1990. We take that out, it starts to get sketchy, doesn't it, Joel?
Yeah, you could see the pop up here to 21.43 and then right back down. If you do go into rally mode here at all, you got three highs right around yesterday's high at 20.60, we'll call that resistance. Coming on the downside here, Dennis, you did mention the parallels just under 20. Below that, a level I like better. Real interest if we get down here to the 1930 area. I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lows in a row right at 19.25. That's about 85 cents away.
8:15.
Look at that.
Right on time.
Yep,
right on time.
Time flies when you're having fun, Dennis. It's 8:14. We're going to take our first break of the day. We're going to grab Paul Milijanovic. He's the author of Stock Investing for Dummies and The Raving Capitalist. So we'll be right back with Paul. All All right, welcome back, traders and investors, to Benzinga's Pre-Market Prep. I'm Spencer Israel, and we're here now with Paul Mladenovic. He is author of a few things, actually, The Raving Capitalist and also Stock Investing for Dummies, which is recently, I saw, made its way among the Amazon bestsellers. So congratulations, Paul.
Oh, thank you kindly. And thank you for having me on the program again. I love speaking to the Benzinga audience.
Love having you. So I saw an article you did, an interview you did with MarketWatch a few weeks ago, and you're giving your thoughts on gold. You basically said that gold is not done climbing. Well, precious metals in general, you seem rather bullish on. Explain why you think that.
Well, right now, the new paradigm, if you want to call it that, for 2017 and beyond, I think it's going to be more inflation than before. Gold and silver were more, people were flocking to it in prior years because of a safe harbor issue. They worried about economic crisis. And it was plenty of talk about potentially large problems with the economy, a debt bubble popping, et cetera. And although some of those things haven't, changed, I think that the new mindset in Washington for regulatory reform and tax cuts, I think, will bode well for the economy. So I'm generally bullish, on quality stocks in general. But not only that, but all the infrastructure spending that's going to be coming down the pike, and so much expansion of spending, the gap is going to be more money supply, which means it's inflationary. And I think the January showed that there was a bump up in inflation, and I think that it'll only continue. So gold and silver are good holdings as a portion of a diversified portfolio before because of the safe harbor aspects of it, but now because of the inflation hedge aspects of it.
I'm glad you brought up infrastructure. I'm not sure if you saw yesterday, the American Society of Civil Engineers came out with their report that only comes out once every 4 years, and it came out yesterday, and once again, they gave America a D in terms of infrastructure, bridges, aviation, water, the whole nine yards, and pretty much everything got it. Overall, we got a D in terms of our infrastructure. So I want to ask you about where specifically do you think the spending will be? There's a lot to be spent, right? I think that's pretty clear at this point. Where do you think that the money will focus on?
Well, first of all, with the infrastructure, I mean, a lot of the components of the Dow and the S&P 500, if people shift over to things like, for example, those companies involved in defense and aerospace, those are going to benefit. A lot of the companies involved in building infrastructure, the most obvious trade, definitely. And beneath the surface, I think that commodities are also showing strength as well, because obviously if you're going to be rebuilding bridges and you need copper and steel and so much more, basic commodities I think will do very well. And in addition, because part of what's going on as well from a different angle as well, silver, I mentioned, has a component similar to gold, but it also has industrial aspects. And when we have more expansion, things like electronics and more solar panels are going to be constructed, that bodes well for that as well. So there's a lot of bullish opportunities out there, but there's also bearish opportunities as well.
What are your thoughts on this Trump rally that we're in? Do you think it... if you want to call it top, cool. If you don't, cool. But do you think it'll keep going? Do you think we're at where we're at? I mean, thoughts on
that? Well, I think the Dow will be hitting new highs in the next few years, but this one definitely is overdone. I think it's there's an overbought condition to it, and I think some pullback I think will definitely be in the cards soon. So I think for some of those folks who've been running a long time and sitting on profits, some of the defensive folks out there may want to consider, reallocating, some of their money, or possibly putting on some stop loss orders on this and putting them on good till canceled. But in addition, I mentioned in a prior remark about bearish opportunities, sometimes, like a rising tide lifts all boats. And I think that there's a lot of overpriced assets out there, including some out there that are, I think who are raking in losses and not profits, like some of the social media stocks. So I think now, when there's a market pullback, the bad stocks are going to fall faster and harder than the good ones. The good ones will rebound from it in due course. But I think now people should start taking a look at, again, defensive plays for their good positions and start looking around for positions. If they're looking for trading opportunities, I think there's some great bearish opportunities now, because those things in the short term, I think, will pull back, and there could be some good short-term profits available for, the traders out there.
Let's talk about some of those short-term bearish opportunities in the social media sector. Can you throw a few names our way? I mean, one that comes to the top of the list, Twitter just fading into oblivion here. I guess you wouldn't want to touch the Facebook that's hot. Give us a couple issues here that you're looking at from the short side.
Well, I think Twitter, you know, obviously losing a lot of money, and I thought there was some great bearish profits in that in recent years. You could just take a look at the chart, you know. Obviously, when it rallied up, it was a great time to put in, say, like a long-dated put options. Because as much as I've made a lot of, decent profits in the short-term trades, but most of the time it's been because of put options. I would never go short because if it goes against you, it's more harm than good. Another one that I've been eyeing is, did you want me to mention a specific?
Yeah.
I saw the other day that the numbers on Wayfair I thought were not good. You know, that's the site that's, selling furniture and stuff.
Correct.
And I've seen them having plenty of losses there. So stocks like that, I mean, anybody in your audience, you know, should take a look, some of the cyclicals. And, the social media stocks, a lot of those, they have name recognition and they have an appeal and a sexiness. But look, you got to look at the numbers. You got to look at the net, the income statements and the balance sheets. And that's the great thing about today. You know, there's lots of sites out there that'll give you all that data and you can start putting in your positions. Now, it doesn't mean those things can't go up another week or so. But for people who want to trade it, I'd buy a nice long-dated put option because that way, look, these things, you never know if these things are going to collapse like a week from now or a month from now. So even when I think that there's going to be, that something's going to pull back sharply in a few weeks, I'll still buy a long-dated put option because I have the luxury of time at that point. A lot of these folks who buy like a three-month put option, then those stand to be, wasted, in that regard. But something like a 12 or an 18-month put option would be a good play now because there's going to be a pullback in some of these things, definitely, and the weaker stocks are great candidates for, long-dated put options.
Before we let you go, Paul, I just want to ask you about the financial sector here. I mean, it's trading like, rates are going up a quarter or a half. I don't know how many times this year. Hot sector. I mean, if you've been fighting it since the election, you've been on the wrong side of it. Where do the financials fit into your scenario, your market scenario?
Well, again, a lot of them are tied to debt and they're tied to interest rates. And I think that this is a very... a dubious area. I generally avoid financials unless I thought the economy was stable. But what kind of stability has been showing lately? Yes, it's been good. You're right about that. It's ebullient. Financials have been among the top performers over the last like 3 months or so. But I think this is another example where there's some overbought conditions. And when you're talking about a potential debt crisis, again, that might not happen next week. But when interest rates start to pop up, I think that some of the weaker financial issues will have a strong pullback. So here, I'm going to be more careful. I tell my investors, shy away from the financial sector for now. But for the folks out there who trade or speculate, I think there might be some good opportunities here, on the short-term bearish side.
All right. We've been on the line with Paul Mladenovic, author of Stock Investing for Dummies and the Raven Capitalist. Paul, thanks a lot for hopping on today. We'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, I wish all of you prosperity. Thanks again.
All right. We're going to now bring on someone who's not been on the show for quite a while, and that's our own Brent Slava from the news desk, and Brent's going to give us a little preview of the jobs number.
Hey, it's been way too long.
It has been way too long. How's it going?
Since I've been on. It's going good. Thanks for having me. Love coming on. So we got about 4 minutes or so, Joel. Five minutes and 30 seconds. Give you a quick preview of the numbers here. So there are several sectors which are measured with the jobs report. The important ones are the non-farm sector and the private sector. And the current economist estimate for non-farm is 200,000. That would be down slightly from the reading in March, which was 227,000. Also, the private sector payroll current estimate is 193,000. That would be down from 237,000 in January. Did I say February before? One more. Unemployment rate is going to be expected to be about 4.7%. That would be down from a reading of 4.8% in January, and we are now under 4 minutes. We're going to have the jobs number out in 4 minutes, ladies and gentlemen.
So, Brent, do those estimates change at all for the recent ADP data that we had? Because
yes.
We know the ADP number was hot. So did they jack up those numbers once they got that ADP data?
I wouldn't say they jacked them up. They went up a little bit. Think I remember looking at the estimate last Friday, and I want to say it was for the non-farm, just to give you a little bit of a factor here. Non-farm estimate was 193 last Friday. So up about 7,000 jobs or so. The estimate went up about 7,000 jobs. Nothing too crazy, really. Dennis?
With that good ADP number, doesn't it make you think that this is going to be a hot number here too?
Without the estimates being jacked, kind of, as you said it, I would be sort of where I'm leaning.
All right, Brent, sir, can I get anybody on the half a point raise next week? I seem to be the only one on Wall Street.
I like your thesis. It's going out there a little bit. I think I want to say it's just going to be consistent raising.
Yeah,
it's not going to be like a stair step higher. It's going to be, you know, a baby step higher, a baby step higher, a baby step higher, that kind of thing. That's my personal take.
Does this number even matter? Are they raising rates here no matter what? Unless it's a complete,
completely bad or completely
ever.
Good, right? Like a huge beat or a huge miss. I think I'm kind of on par with you, Dennis. But, you know, the payroll figures on the Fridays, they have been the more important data point. However, Dennis, you know, I think you've been saying this for a while. These economic data points are kind of becoming less meaningful. In a way, they're not quite causing as much action and stuff when right after they hit. I think
what do you think the reason is? Just because this market just doesn't have the fear in it, maybe, eh? Because, you know, we used to trade. I used to trade these jobs. I'm going to trade this one here in a minute. But I used to want to be, you know, not even doing the radio show for 5 minutes before, 5 minutes after, because
right,
there's so much volatility. I've been making so many trades, and now it's kind of been like crickets a little bit, you know,
right,
on some of these jobs, where we move 2 or 3 points, and it's like, as a trader, you want volatility. So, you know, I've been disappointed the last few, actually probably for the last year of jobs
right.
numbers, because they just aren't moving the market much anymore.
I don't know. Do you think it has anything to do with just, like, the speed of information, Dennis? I mean, do you think over the last 2 or 3 years, the way we get information has just sped up so much that people are just, like, I don't know, really getting ahead of this stuff?
You could be right. There might be a point to think about there, too. I also think it just has to do with this market just wants to find a reason always to buy it, it seems like. And, you know, every time you sell off a little bit, everybody's lurking in the background to buy those dips. So it's just not as much fear out there right now. I really think that's why the lack of volatility, even after the jobs numbers, because we don't see lack of volatility. We see a lack of volatility all the time now. So,
right.
You know, the VIX, where are we on the VIX here? Just looking.
Zero.
Yeah, we're trading 11.96. I mean, the fear out there is like nothing. There's no fear. There's more fear to be out of this market than fear to be in the market.
Good point. Excellent point. All right, that is 8:29 here. We are approaching the jobs number. Now, the early trading in the S&P has been nothing but straight up here. Opened at 67.5, just went one tick below your close at 66. Actually, we maxed the close at 66.25, and it's just been a climb up here. I got a shorter term chart here so we can see all the actions once the market makers drop their bids and offers on this number. The jobs number seem the only number that anyone really cares about here. As they say on CNBC here, jobs report imminent. Markets are holding steady. Crude trading up 29 cents. Usually get a good move in gold and silver off these numbers here. We are waiting for the number.
235,000 on non-farm figures. Estimate was for 200,000. The private sector coming in at 227,000. The estimate was for 193,000. Unemployment rate is flat, 4.7%. That was down from 4.8%. It was in line with the economist's estimate. So one more time, we do have beats on the private and non-farm figures. What is the S&P doing, Joel?
It's not moving. Dennis will be back here in about 38 seconds.
Back here in 3 seconds. I was like waiting for all the volatility, and we moved 2 points. I mean, we're still digesting here, so we're going to, you know, get a little bit more chop. I did notice a little bit of the financials. They were trading at, like, Bank of America 65, just dropped to 55. Now it's all the way back at 65, so we're chomping around a little bit here, but I mean, that's a 1 or 2 point move, yeah. 3 point move here. We just get like 15 point moves on the initial number, and it's just crickets.
We got to find a new indicator here. That's
new way
be...
of volatility. We need to find some way for volatility to come back in this market. One thing as a trader, and I know if you're an investor, investors love this market, the slow, steady climb. There's no real chop out. As a trader, as a short-term trader, I want chop. I want volatility. I want fear out there a little bit because, you know, that's where you get little inefficiencies that come into the market. So when it's just sitting here and just, you know, the slow, steady climb, it's boring for a day trader like me. And I want action. I'm complaining here today.
What are they considering full employment? Is this the number that the Fed has earmarked? Is it 4.5, 4.6, 4.7? Because, I mean, we're getting down there. I mean, that was one of the benchmarks. Also, inflation. Do you know what it is that – what they're using?
I want to say 4% flat, wow. Maybe. 4 or 4.5. It's somewhere right around where we're at right now, Joel.
Dennis, what's the unemployment rate in Canada?
Throw me under the bus again. I have no idea.
He doesn't even know that.
I train the U.S. markets.
He never leaves his house. He doesn't even know if there's other people out there working. But boy, oh boy. I mean, we shot up to 2378, 2 points off that. I mean, I'll give you a number upside. Monday's high, 2380.75. That certainly looks like a target on the upside. I'm talking the March contract here. There is a lot of volume trading in the June as well. Actually, I'm looking now and there's been equal volume. I'll be back, have my June numbers on Monday for you. But right now, still keeping an eye on the September contract. Dennis, I guess we could go back to some of the earnings. We did cover Alta, but what about...
We have most of them covered. It was a light day there. You were talking Cara yesterday, and CARA is getting the beats. It's one of the losers on the loser board, Cara Therapeutics. Disappointing the street here because it's trading down $1.50 here in the pre-market. So some fairly significant size on the offer, too. I see 20,000 shares offered at $15.99. So some big guy is saying, hey, or big girl is saying, hey, I think the stock is going lower.
That's a big offer for a pre-market, huh?
And a stock like Cara? Oh, yeah. 20,000 shares, that's significant. What'd they say, Spencer?
81-cent loss versus a 48-cent loss estimate. They didn't give sales.
You know what is moving here off these numbers is Bob Weyer is pointing out gold and silver here are getting a boost. Green on the session here. Yep. You can see gold, so maybe some inflationary tones there. There's a nice pop in gold back. We'll see if we can close back over 1,200. Silver, which got down to 16.855, is now back over $17. Also, crude is getting a little bit of a lift off this, too, trading up 32 cents. At 49.60. All right.
Financials are leaking a little bit here again, too. Bank of America's lost another dime here again. So a little small leak here in the financials, but they're still up a lot on the day just because they were up so much ahead of the number.
It's 8:34 now. We're going to take our second break of the day. We're going to grab Michael Carvin. He's the co-founder and CEO of a company called Smart Asset. And they have some investing guides and some really good resources there for as far as managing your portfolio is concerned. So we'll be right back with Michael. Welcome back, traders and investors. This has been Zynga's Pre-Market Prep. I'm Spencer Israel here with Joel Alkonin and Dennis Dick. We're on the line now with the company that I believe will be at the Benzinga FinTech Awards as Smart Asset and their co-founder and CEO, Michael Carvin. Mike, how's it going today?
I'm doing great. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So tell us a little bit about Smart Asset. You guys do a lot of different things all within the realm of education, more or less. So tell us about what Smart Asset really is.
So we are your go-to resource for getting personal finance advice online. So we think of ourselves as, you know, whether you're trying to get retirement advice, tax advice, life insurance advice, home ownership advice, we want to be your first point of reference. So it's a lot of tools, a lot of content, all designed to help you make better financial decisions.
And one of those areas is investing, and that's what we're focused on because our listeners are all trade and they invest. And you have a lot of really interesting tools on the platform. You have the brokerage calculator, the investment calculator, you have the asset allocation calculator, the inflation calculator, the capital gains calculator. So how did you know to come up with this stuff? What happened to you to make you want to start Smart Asset?
Yeah, so it actually all started when I went to buy a home about 5 years ago now. I had been working in finance for a long time. And like a lot of people, you know, after the Great Recession, thinking about buying a house, I was worried about making a bad financial decision. Went online to do a lot of research and frankly found a lot of tools that I thought were lacking, weren't providing great accuracy advice, weren't providing a great user experience. And I went home, and not thinking too much of it at the time, I built this giant financial model that told me, you know, what I could afford, what mortgage made the most sense, what are the tax consequences of buying a home, and, you know, bigger picture, does buying a home, you know, again, remember, you know, in the wake of the Great Recession, does buying a home even make any sense, you know, relative to the alternatives, right, relative to renting? And realized in the process of doing that, in the process of sharing that giant financial model with friends and family that, wow, you know, people could really benefit from getting dramatically more accurate, more personalized financial advice, and that the financial model would be a good tool for doing that. In talking to people about, how they were filling that need at the time, I realized that this wasn't a problem that was, just related to buying houses and figuring out whether that made sense. It was about financial decision-making in general. It was about retirement planning. It was about investing. It was about, all those topics that I talked about. And I realized that we could build a company around driving dramatically better personal finance advice.
So you realize that, there's more to it than just buying a house. There's insurance, there's retirement, there's credit cards, there's everything. So do you have a background in entrepreneurship? How did you go about starting the company, really?
No, I've been working in finance for about 7 years, which I think is actually the worst preparation you can possibly have for starting a company. That's a whole other conversation, but no real background in company building or in being an entrepreneur. I think what I realized though is that, that the market opportunity for driving a much better product, the product experience around helping people make these better financial decisions because the existing tools were so bad meant that, we could make a lot of mistakes and still be able to build a really valuable company, a really valuable offering.
And how do you know what to add? It seems silly in hindsight, but how do you know that people are looking for or looking to compare their online brokerages, right? How do you figure that out?
Yeah, so we do an enormous amount in the investing and retirement space because frankly those are really complicated decisions that are they're deeply personalized. The hard thing in our space isn't figuring out, and this is something that I really truly believe about personal finance. The hard thing isn't trying to figure out what are the questions that people are asking, because for the most part, we're asking the same kind of questions. What does a healthy retirement look like for me? How do I meet my investment goals? What's the most tax efficient strategy, I should say, for investing my money? And so we're all basically asking those questions. The really hard part about building our product is that personal finance advice needs to be just that, needs to be personalized. And that while we're all asking those same questions, everyone needs a different answer. And so building a product solution, a software solution that can drive a personalized answer for everyone in the U.S., regardless of whether you're 60 years old and retired and live in Florida or 20 years old and, getting your first job and living in Silicon Valley, you might be asking similar questions about what you need to do for a comfortable retirement. But frankly, the complexity of delivering an answer that's accurate for both of those two people is really pretty high. So that's one of the really hard things about what we do.
And so, you guys are up for a Benzinga FinTech Award. You're nominated in the Best Educational Platform Tool or App category. And there are lots of educational platforms out there. So, what would you say that makes Smart Asset different?
Yeah, so we're obviously in the advice space. And so when we think about, well, how do we deliver the best advice on the web, we think of that in two ways. Advice needs to be accurate. So we need to make sure that, you know, in the same way that a doctor's diagnosis needs to be really accurate, we need to be really accurate. We need to make sure that at all times we're delivering the math in an incredibly accurate, very correct way. And we spent over a year and a half building our back end patent pending platform we call AFM, Automated Financial Modeling. And that's that's basically like simulation software that a financial advisor would use. It can do everything from, helping you figure out how much life insurance you need to, helping you figure out, if, what your taxes would be on a federal, state, and local level. And so the accuracy piece is incredibly important. The second piece is the, how do you communicate that advice to a user piece, right? So, how do we position the advice so that it's easy to understand, interactive, interesting, without being, overly simple or overly complicated? We think of that as, use the doctor analogy again, our bedside manner, right? We could have the most accurate diagnosis in the world, but if I'm, if I'm not communicating that to you in a way that you can't take action, then that advice isn't really valuable. So we think really hard about the user experience. We think really hard about the accuracy piece. And those two things together, are how we think of ourselves in terms of delivering a really quality advice product. And frankly, we're just light years ahead of everyone else. I mean, there are 2,000 income tax jurisdictions just in Pennsylvania. The complexity of building a software solution that can model all of those for the two different income tax codes we have, the traditional and the alternative minimum tax. I mean, it's a super, super complex problem, and no one even approaches the sophistication that we bring to that, which allows us to create, these really elegant user experiences, because we're actually able to do all of the heavy lifting for you. You integrate with over 150 different data resources, including all of your, all of the tax resources, so that I don't need to ask you what your marginal income tax is when we're trying to give you advice. We know that. And so that, it really creates a much stronger product experience. And what that means for the user is that they get better advice wrapped in a better user experience. And we see that obviously also through our engagement rates, which are generally about 10 times what our competitors do. So we think really hard about delivering a better product experience.
We're on the line with Michael Carvin, CEO and co-founder of Smart Asset. My question for you is, what is your target audience? What kind of traffic have you been seeing? Are you targeting millennials? Is this site, are you trying to get anybody, towards retirement? What's your target market?
Yeah, look, we really think of us as, democratizing access to high quality advice. And so we're for everybody. Anyone who's asking these personal finance questions, our goal is to make sure that you feel like you have access to great financial advice. So, our audience skews a little bit younger in our homeownership areas. It skews a little bit older in our retirement and investing areas. But we really think of ourselves as, trying to provide that advice in a friendly, friendly, objective way. I think we've been one of the faster growing companies in the U.S., certainly when measured by audience as well. We're about 10x the audience we were 15, 16 months ago, now reaching, north of 40 million uniques per month.
We've been on the line with Michael Carvin. He's the co-founder and CEO of Smart Asset. Mike, I hope you'll be at the Benzinga FinTech Awards in May, because you're up for an award, and I hope you win. Michael Carvin, thanks a lot for joining us today, and hope to see you at the Benzinga FinTech Awards in May.
Great. Thanks so much, guys.
And back to the markets, Joel. How are we doing on the S&Ps?
Climbing the wall here, up 12.25, 2378.50, 79.25 is the high. Financials, everything holding pretty steady here. The S&Ps just at the highs of the session. Number on the upside, if you're looking for a target, 2380.75. That was Monday's high. We're about a 1.5 away from there. Dennis, anything moving on
you
your
know
screen?
What I find interesting here is that everything is kind of like, there's not a lot of rotation here today. It seems like everything is catching a bid. Like, look, gold is now in the green. Silver is in the green here. You've got the TLT trading in the green just slightly, mind you. You know, XLU has just went green here now. And the financials are green. I mean, all of a sudden, everybody likes the fact that interest rates are going higher. It's a hard market to figure out.
All right. Yeah, especially with the utilities. But I guess this is already, baked in here that we're going to get a number. The utilities have come off kind of hard here from the 52 level. I'm looking at the XLU finding support at 50. So is it just going to be one of those things that just a buy everything market? I see crude here.
We've seen it, you know, a couple of times. You know, you see this every once in a while. They're just, everything is up. But typically what happens is, you know, for, you know, people who don't listen to our show, I usually approach, you know, the morning with the risk on, risk off theme. It looks risk on all the way. But then you start to think, okay, well, usually when it's risk on, usually your bonds are getting hit. Usually money is rotating out of some other assets to come in. I don't know, maybe it's just rotating out of cash to get in here, because with the TLT trading higher, I would think if this is a hot number and they think interest rates are going higher, I would think they hit the TLT. But maybe they've hit it hard enough that, you know, they're done hitting it here. And obviously, you know, that's why it's not trading down here today. And, you know, if the TLT is trading, you know, up, then you think all your defensive stocks are probably not going to go down either, because those move more with bonds. You know, I'm thinking like the stocks, even like the AT&Ts and Verizons, a lot of times those actually move with the bonds with the TLT better than they do with the SPY. So, but, you know, right now, this morning, a lot of things bid up.
How about the fact that we've already had a 13.5-point range here, and the 9-day average trading range is only 15 points? So is this going to be a day where we open up 12.5 and end up 25 or 30? Or do you think, you know, just the range trainers and the grind, you know, maybe be hitting our early morning high and back and fill a little bit?
Like, originally I thought if the number is hot, the jobs meet, or the financials, and I can't talk now, financials maybe catch another bid. And then, you know, I thought maybe 10 o'clock some profit comes out of it, because like it did on the ADP number here. But it's just no volatility, no chat, and it's just slowly stepping up. Makes me think this could be like just like the day, like you're saying, that we end up 25 or 30 handles again. Remember, we had one of these last week. It was after the Trump speech.
Yep.
And we just, you know, slow, steady climb up. I mean, I guess everything was kind of what we expected here. The jobs number was pretty decent. It wasn't super, super, you know, blowing it all away to give the financials even more of a lift, but it was a good number. And, I mean, interest rates are going higher here. It's just surprising that, you know, like I was always taught in school, when interest rates are going higher, the stock market starts to not like it. And the stock market seems to love it, which, you know, really intuitively to me makes no sense at all. But, you know, this is the market that we're in. We're in this, you know, everything is awesome environment here is what everybody has the mentality of. And, you know, they keep buying stocks hand over fist. And today they just seem to be buying everything, gold included. And gold just slightly dip to the red, but an incredible market, really.
All right. We got a disaster of the day to talk about.
Ooh, let's talk something
negative. Yeah, let's just get some negativity in here, all this good positive stuff here. Finisar. We got some numbers on Finisar. From the Q3 and some guidance here. Spencer, you want to hit us with those numbers?
Well, the Q3 was bad, but not like awful. It was a Q3 EPS of 59 cents versus 62 cents, sales of 380 million versus 389 million. Q4, that missed too, and when you combine a miss on the guidance and a miss on the earnings, that's what you get. EPS for Q4, 50 cents to 56 cents, that's the range that they see. 58 cents was the estimate, sales of 360 to 380 million dollars, 393 was the estimate, so they pretty much missed across the board.
Stock going from its near its highs of the year right to near its lows of the year. We did get down to 27.22 back on the 23rd. What's the pre-market low here,
27.10, Dennis. 27.
Holy cow, man. These levels work. We're telling you guys. These levels work.
All right, and getting a little bounce here. You hit 27.10. Then you tried to climb into the 30 handle. You were turned back there, a seller at the point, now consolidating around 29. That fact that we rallied $3 off that pre-market low at 27.10, and also that it coincides with a low that Dennis just mentioned at 27.22, that could be a target here on the downside. Over 30, you could get a little bit of a pop, but looks like someone really wants to sell this stock at 30.
B. Morris is finding us some other stocks here that have been in the doghouse here. Caterpillar, he's saying it might hit $90. You know what? I think I agree with him here. I think it could hit 90 eventually. It's getting a lift in the whole buy everything market is today, but this is one that I maybe look to fade on the pops because there's still a lot of unknowns here. We talked about it. It has been a dog the last couple of days, so it's getting a nice lift. Yesterday's high might be a good place to look for a short. I don't know if it gets that high to 93.22, but gets in the upper 92s. I might look to fade this thing too.
And yeah, that ongoing investigation, you don't know what's gonna
unknowns
happen with that.
I like being short unknowns.
Right. The thing that you have to think about here, B. Morris, is that if it does crack 90, okay, then you're talking about, you know, some gap to fill area here. He had a gap up day. I don't know, was that when was that? Oh, the election. All of a sudden Caterpillar was the greatest stock to own. So you have a gap to fill in the cat. You had a low at 89.36, and that was a big gap up from 85 even. So if in fact you can get under 90, get some pressure here, maybe we can get down there and fill that gap. That's a big gap to fill from the election. Zoomies had earnings, I believe. They sell stuff in malls, right? Zoomies is the shoes and stuff. Teen Place.
I don't know. What does Zoomies do?
I thought it was Zooms. I guess it is Zoomies. Okay.
Q4, we don't know how to pronounce it.
Q4 EPS.
I've traded it before, though.
Q4 EPS of 74 cents versus 50 cents in the same quarter last year. Sales 263.6 versus 242.4. So they beat that number. Year-over-year comps up about 5%. They see the Q1 EPS at a 21-cent loss to a 17-cent loss. 3-cent loss is the estimate, so not looking good on that. Sales 178 to $182 million. 186 was the estimate, so they kind of missed. They did miss on the guidance for Q1.
Joel, correct. And a whole theme of hitting retail stocks this quarter continues here because this is a specialty retailer in apparel. And that is not what you want to be in, at least from the long side in this quarter, because they have hit so many apparel stocks here in this quarter. And Zoomies is the latest disaster in the apparel sector.
17 even is your pre-market low. Got a nice bounce off that, a buck and a quarter. Can't get through 18 and a quarter here. It's currently where we're stuck. So if you come back down to that 17 area, the fact we bounced off it could be some support. Going back to levels we saw in September 2016, a monthly low at 1601, but got some work to do at 17 even if in fact we get down to that pre-market low. Dennis, that your stock that you're probably an expert on, CNQ.
Because it's got Canadian Natural Resources. I actually had this one in my investment portfolio for a long time, and it's no longer in there. I sold it here about 6 months ago, right in the same area here. But it was a stock that got hit obviously hard, and it came back. You know, this was one that came back a long ways from the lows here, with oil prices obviously. CNQ, good day last couple of days. Remember, though, you know, you've got to always look when you're trading a Canadian, you know, stock that's listed on the U.S. I like to look at it, what it's done in its domestic currency, which would be Canadian dollars, because the Canadian dollar has been hit here the last couple of days. And when the Canadian dollar gets hit, actually your prices will rally more on the U.S. because of the exchange rate. So CNQ showing a big pop last 2 days. A little bit of that, though, is to do with the dollar. But CNQ has been up even the last couple of days on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Trading at 43 on the TSE. It was up $3 yesterday.
All right, they did something with Marathon Oil yesterday. I think they did a partnership. Marathon Oil got a nice boost off it, even though you had a negative crude oil market. But CNQ, the chart doesn't look too bad here. Let's see if I can just give you just need a continuation through this $32 level. You see the high yesterday in the lower 32s, couple lows in the lower 32s here back going to December. So we'll keep an eye on that. Wave Trader here, El Poco Loco. We haven't talked about that stock in quite
a while. It always makes me and Ace think of Breaking Bad. with that, because that was similar to the name of the restaurant where they hit all the drugs.
Los Pollos Hermanos, is that it?
Is that what it was on Breaking Bad?
Actually, we have an article.
That's
up.
Where they did the meth lab, was below that, wasn't it?
Yes. So we have an actual article up today on Benzinga.com about sort of how chicken wings have become the biggest headwind for chicken wing restaurants and just the pricing of chicken wings. So I would, if you're watching Loco, I would check out that.
Stock has just been ugly into this report here. So it did report there last night. And what were the numbers, Spencer? Do you have the actual numbers?
Yeah, 12 cents versus 15 cents year over year. Sales 92.47 versus 86.3 year over year. So year over year, they're looking good. And then as far as guidance goes, fiscal year, adjusted EPS 65 to 69 cents. That's in line with the estimate. So Q4 their year over year was not great. Actually, quarter for Q4 as far as the estimate, they came in a penny lower than the estimate on the EPS, and they came in about $1 million higher on the sales number. So the Q4 was a slight beat as far as estimate goes, a miss as far as year over year goes.
No trades this morning, but this was actively trading last night in the 1085, 1095 area. This is a tick size pilot stock, so trades in nickels. It's one of those that obviously, you know, for the next 2 years are going to be trading in nickels. It's offered pretty heavily at 1125 here, which would put it down 10 cents. But like I said, it was actively trading around 1085, 1095 last night. That's probably where it wants to go today.
Yeah, 1050, that's your pre-market low here. The all-time low for the issue, if you take out that 1050, is 9.58. So keep an eye on that if, in fact, you can take out the pre-market low. All right, Spencer.
It is 8:59, Joel, and that means we have to bring in our final guest of the week, and that's Adam Feuerstein. He is the senior columnist and reporter at The Street. If you are at all interested in biotech, you really want to hear this. He's maybe the most influential biotech reporter out there. So we'll be right back now with Adam Feuerstein. Welcome back, traders and investors. This has been Zynga's Pre-Market Prep. I'm Spencer Israel here with Joel Elkanian. We're on the line now with Adam Feuerstein, senior reporter and columnist at The Street. Adam, how's it going today?
Spencer, good. Thanks.
Thanks for coming on. I want to get your thoughts right off the bat now about drug pricing and the state of drug pricing. What realistically do you think, if anything, Trump will do? And then we'll go into specifics from there as far as drug pricing goes.
Well, you know, like it's been for, you know, probably for the last, you know, 2 years, you know, drug pricing obviously is a huge issue and a lot of uncertainty around it because, you know, no one really knows what's going to happen. And I think that's exactly what's, you know, basically the status today is I don't think anyone really knows. You know, Trump has signaled, obviously has talked about drug pricing and talked about wanting to do things about drug pricing. There are no specifics been put on the table necessarily. And there's some contradictions there in terms of the way you go about it. You know, Trump at times talks a lot about getting rid of regulations, increasing competition, as a way of ameliorating drug pricing. Whereas other people, you know, particularly some people in Congress, want sort of more of a direct approach. You know, want to allow the government, you know, specifically Medicare, to negotiate drug prices. And you know, so we really don't know what's going to happen yet. You know, until there's specific proposals or bills sort of put on the table.
Now, if we were to see some sort of drug pricing legislation, which stocks do you think are the most vulnerable to being affected adversely by that or positively?
Well, again, it depends on what, you know, it depends on what sort of legislation is proposed. You know, if you want to talk about kind of the worst case scenario, because I know everyone sort of wants to be doomsday. So we can talk about, you know, worst case would be, you know, legislation that allows the government to create their own formulary for drugs that would allow, you know, again, which basically would give the government leverage to say no to specific drugs and negotiate prices lower. That would be kind of the worst case scenario. And, you know, in that case, you would, the drug companies that would be most vulnerable would be, you know, companies or drugs where there are where there is a lot of competition, because that's how you sort of play one company or one drug against another. And maybe the best example in the private sector today would be the hepatitis C drugs. So, you know, Gilead, AbbVie, Merck, where there are, you know, multiple drugs that all do a great job at curing hepatitis C, but what the private insurers have been able to do is kind of is play one against the other, right, and wrestle, you know, price concessions out of companies to keep them on formulary. So the way you probably would want to think about it is, you know, what the companies or the drugs that would be most vulnerable are those where there are, you know, lots of competition. So diabetes, multiple sclerosis, you know, rheumatoid arthritis, those kinds of categories where, you know, patients and doctors have options, is where you would probably have the most vulnerabilities. You know, on the other side, drugs that are particularly unique, maybe one of a kind, where there's not a lot of competition, in that case, there isn't really a lot of leverage for the government to say, hey, you need to lower the prices because there's no alternative.
Thanks for the breakdown on that. I want to move on now to an M&A rumor that we got a couple days ago. NVO and GBT, we had the NVO CEO confirm they do have some M&A aspirations, did not confirm that GBT was the target of those aspirations. What do you think about this potential rumor?
You know, it's sort of GBT, you know, is developing a drug that the lead indication is cystic fibrosis. Sickle cell. Sickle cell disease with sort of a secondary indication of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, which is a lung disorder. It sort of fits in, you know, kind of fits in with, it's kind of with the strategic focus of what Novo is looking for. So, you know, there has been some some reputable media outlets that have kind of reported on that interest. You know, I have no insight as to whether or not a deal like that is going to happen. I've liked Global Blood Therapeutics for a long time, just sort of based on the data that they have produced for their lead drug in sickle cell. I think it's pretty interesting, and you know they're moving into a phase 3 study now. So you know it sort of fits in with that general theme of these big pharma companies sort of looking to smaller biotechs for growth.
I want to ask you something that actually we talked about a few weeks ago, about a month ago, and you tweeted about this, and it kind of sparked a conversation on our show. You tweeted that the brutally honest lesson, this is regarding Gilead's guidance, is that curing diseases is great for patients and bad for business. And this kind of sparked a discussion that we had on our show that morning. So what did you take away from that? I mean, Gilead came out a month ago. They had really, really bad guidance. It's because their drug worked.
Right.
People don't need it anymore. So what would you say to people then, you know, thinking about investing in the space? Or, like, how do you reconcile that going forward?
Well, I think the point that I was making, and I was being a little, you know, sort of maybe probably exaggerating a little bit.
Okay.
But, the idea is if you think about it conceptually, the sort of the best business model is in a chronic disease where, you know, you're developing a drug and you're selling a drug that a patient needs all the time, and really kind of, so you're not curing the disease, but you're basically treating the symptoms of the disease. So the patient takes it chronically, whether that's like once a week, once a day, once a month, whatever it happens to be, right? So you basically have that patient, you know, as long as that patient is alive, you can have that patient. And the best, sort of the best model for that is HIV. If you think about HIV, where HIV used to be a fatal disease, we developed all these antiretroviral drugs for HIV that essentially turned HIV into a chronic treatable disease, right? If you use these drugs, you stay compliant, the virus stays suppressed, and you live your life. So Gilead has made billions and billions of dollars with its HIV business because once a patient gets on their HIV drugs, they basically stay on them. Now contrast that with hepatitis C, right, where it's a curable disease. You treat a patient for 8 weeks, and the patient is done, right? That patient is cured. He goes on his life. It's great for the patient because he no longer has hepatitis C, but that's a patient that you sort of take out of the column, you know, the sort of the available column of patients you can treat. And so hepatitis C drugs have been enormously successful, but the number of patients that you can treat are going down. And, you know, there's still a lot out there, but, you know, ultimately, eventually, you know, that patient population is dwindling. So that's kind of the point that I was making, and it kind of points to sort of why Gilead is having so much trouble right now, is because, you know, the number of patients that are taking their hepatitis C drugs is falling, and so is their stock price.
One more from me, and then I'll let Joel put in here. But you wrote yesterday about what you called the gnarly nine, right? Nine stocks that are going to test the FDA's mettle. And you outlined how they're all going to sort of, or how they've, you know, done things in the past to try to get their drugs through. How do you cut through the nonsense when drug companies report this data? Because you outline how all the different ways that they sort of manipulate things and change the data. And
it's not necessarily manipulating data. It's basically, you know, it's clinical data with hair on it.
Right. Okay.
Like all, so the nine companies that I sort of highlighted in that story yesterday all have clinical data for drugs that are just, it's not pristine. It's not like you can look at that data and say, wow, that drug should be approved. Absolutely. They all have question marks and issues and problems that the FDA is going to have to address, and the company is going to have to get in there and try to convince the FDA to approve these drugs. So the point of bringing together these sort of nine companies, and I call them the gnarly nine because all the data has hair on it, is that he's sort of in the age of Trump, where Trump has talked about wanting to sort of lower, you know, get rid of regulations, maybe lower the approval standards that the FDA uses to approve drugs. I think you can kind of look at those nine companies as a proxy for how the FDA is going to act in, you know, during this Trump presidency, assuming that maybe he does something, try to influencing the FDA, whether directly or through whoever he names as FDA commissioner. So, you know, we can look at those and say, wow, look, the FDA sort of compromised, or the approval standards maybe have downshifted a little bit to allow these drugs approved. Or on the other side, if a lot of these drugs get rejected, you know, you can make the argument that the FDA hasn't changed, that the FDA is still the same. And that's kind of why I sort of put that list together, because it'll be interesting to watch those drugs work their way through the FDA review process, you know, over the next year, 18 months.
Adam, I just want to touch on, Trump versus Obamacare. We did touch it at the top of the interview, but right now, I mean, that seems to be the biggest overhang, you know, over, you know, some of these issues in this sector. Not really sure what his plan is or what he's going to do. People coming off the exchange is going to be having a lot of uninsured people. Can you just, you know, give us some potential, you know, winners and losers here when you're looking forward to Trump's policies?
You know, I wish I could, Joel. It's hard to do that right now just because I don't think anybody, you know, we don't really know. We have no estimates sort of as to how many patients might lose their insurance under this new plan, whether it's going to stay the same, what premiums are going to look like. So it's really difficult. I mean, I cover the drug industry, the biotech industry. Obviously the interest is, you can think about it conceptually, right? The more patients who have insurance, the more patients who have access to drugs, prescription drugs, if they're accessing healthcare, you know, it's generally good for biotech and the pharmaceutical industry. But it's very difficult to say right now what is going to happen, because you just don't know what the net add or subtraction of patients, of people having access to the healthcare system through insurance or not. It's hard right now. It's really hard to say. And then, of course, you know, that's not in a vacuum. And now we start talking about drug pricing earlier in this call, and you sort of have to layer on that on top of that. So it's just, it's very difficult. It's very muddled right now, and I don't really know how to handicap it.
All right, I just got one other question for you here. A hot stock last year, Sarepta Therapeutics, gets the approval. And, I mean, you know, when it's going up back in September, it's going from under 30, the stock doubles here. I mean, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, how many people, you know, actually can be treated by this, a very expensive drug? I mean, obviously you could just get, you know, killed trying to short the thing. But when these drugs get approved and, you know, these stocks go to parabolic, you know, like how do you analyze really what the true value is going to be?
Well, you know, I think your audience, maybe your audience is a little bit more trader focused than what I am. So, you know, it's and you're right. Sarepta has been a very volatile stock. It seems to sort of move up and down depending on what analyst either an analyst puts out a bullish note or a bearish note, the company comes out and says something. It's been, and it's all really tied around the launch of their Duchenne muscular dystrophy drug and how well it's doing in the early months of the launch. It's, so there's a lot of volatility there, but at the end of the day, for me personally, the way I look at it, I try to take a lot more sort of long-term fundamental approach. You know, the volatility that you see to me is noise, and it just, at the end of the day, it doesn't really mean anything. What's going to matter is, you know, how well the company sells this first drug, Exondys. You know, whether the studies that they have ongoing are going to sort of prove, you know, beyond the shadow of doubt that the drug actually works, because there's a lot of people who still don't believe that. And then, you know, their underlying technology is producing other drugs for other forms of the disease, and so we have to see how those drugs do in clinical trials. That's going to have the most effect on the company and its stock price. And you know, I do understand and appreciate the fact that traders like to kind of trade all the stock up and down, and look, it probably provides a lot of great opportunities in both directions, but it's, you know, to me, it just doesn't really matter very much.
All right, weaving on the line now with Adam Feuerstein from TheStreet.com. He's their senior columnist and reporter. Adam, thanks a lot for hopping on today. I really appreciate it. If you don't follow Adam on Twitter, you really, really need to. Adam Feuerstein. Adam, thanks so much for hopping on. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right, thanks, guys.
All right, that wraps up another week of pre-market prep. So hope you enjoyed that discussion, folks. Hope you enjoyed all of our shows this week and all of our guests. You can catch our whole show again on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher after the podcast is uploaded, or just listen to the YouTube video after we're done here. Once again, please remember that all the information, material, and content from our show is for informational purposes only and not meant to be investing advice. Have a good rest of your day, everybody. Have a good weekend, and we'll be back with you folks on Monday.
Whether you're a short-term swing trader or a long-term investor, you need to check out Thinkorswim, brought to you by TD Ameritrade. There's a reason why Thinkorswim has been named the number one trading platform, because it has it all. With Thinkorswim, you can trade stocks, options, futures, Forex, and virtually every other type of order. Get notifications on mobile devices and interact with other traders in chat rooms. You can also use technical indicators and see the latest investing and trading education in Think Money magazine. If you want to keep up with the markets, you need Thinkorswim. To experience everything Thinkorswim has to offer, open a TD Ameritrade account today. Thinkorswim, the online trading platform for traders and investors. TD Ameritrade, member SIPC. All investing involves risks.